lectures talking about the real phenomenological challenges and issues that are raised by Lauren and Susie. Just so I have an idea, how many people know all about N equals 1 super? How many people know the MSSM, forwards and backwards? Okay, how many people, forget forwards and backwards, how many people have seen the MSSM Lagrangian? That's almost everybody, maybe half the people. How many people, I just want to get an idea. How many people know all about Weyl fermions? Okay, how many people have seen an index alpha dot? Okay, very good. How many people, what else do I want to know before we start? How many people know what anomaly mediation is? Very good. Okay, excellent. Thank you. So we really will be able to finish all the formulas and we will need by the end of the day. But I actually want to start off picking up a little bit where Jim left off last time, because he said a number of very important things. And they're worth emphasizing again, because it also gives us first motivation for why something should come beyond the standard model, and secondly, why should that thing that comes beyond the standard model be as exciting as supersymmetry? Now, supersymmetry is a pretty damn exciting thing. It's a new space-time symmetry. Why should we be so lucky to be living in the era where we're going to discover new space-time symmetries? Why should it show up at the weak scale? It could show up anywhere. Why should it show up at the weak scale? So I want to spend the first part of today's lecture talking about some of these general motivations. Now, what we've seen so far, up to energies of order hundreds of GeV, we've seen some effective theory which has a bunch of things, but also has the massive W and Z particles. Okay? So let me just schematically put. Okay. And so if you're very, very naive, so no, I'm not the, all I'm saying is that we've seen some massive spin 1 particles, which are, we've seen two sets of massive spin 1 particles, the Z and the W. And that's all we know. So we haven't seen the Higgs, we haven't seen anything else yet directly. This is all we know. Notice I'm just writing these things down in the Lagrangian. They're not gauge invariant. Okay. That's fine. We're physicists, not philosophers. We don't care whether things look pretty or gauge invariant or not. Gauge invariance isn't a symmetry at all, in fact. There's really no content to gauge invariance, and nothing will convince you more of that than the exercise we're about to go through. So there's no such thing as S2 cross U1. There's certainly no such thing as S2 cross U1 breaking. All we have are some massive spin 1 particles. That's it, okay? Together with the rest. But I'm going to focus on these because it's going to make a very important point. And again, Jim said these things yesterday, so I'm going to say them a little rapidly, but it is important. Okay, so let me, in fact, make my life a little easier than the real world. Let me just assume that I have... here we have the W and the Z, and they don't quite have exactly the same mass. Let's just imagine that I have some triplet That I have a global SU2 symmetry, some global SU2 symmetry, under which some spin 1 particles are charged, and so my Lagrangian is, there's some trace F mu nu squared, and then there's just some M squared W mu W mu. Okay? So I just have an SU2's worth of a massive spin 1 particle. Now, if you were to look at this Lagrangian, it just looks like you have a massive spin 1 particle. And now let's recouple it to the rest of the world. If you were to ask, what does this theory do at very high energies? Okay? At very high energies, well, naively, at very high energies, I can ignore the mass of this spin 1 particle. And I just have some theory for the mass of spin 1 particle. And the theory, you know, goes to very high energies, and maybe somewhere at the Planck scale it breaks down. Maybe up at the Planck scale we don't know what's going on. Here's the mass of the particle m. But you would think that as you go above here, there's a perfectly nice healthy theory and only something breaks down at around the Planck scale. You're very naive. Okay. And I emphasize, again, this is our situation today. Our situation today is we've seen massive W and Z particles. Here's a simplified version of the situation where we've just seen this massive triplet of spin 1 particles. And this is what's actually incorrect. This theory does not make sense all the way up to the Planck scale. And in fact, doesn't make sense to energies much higher than the mass of the particle itself. Although it does make sense to energies parametrically higher than the mass of the particle. I'm going to now tell you that, let me just put a g squared here. So let me call this scale d squared. So putting the g squared there, the m squared, g squared v squared. Okay. What I'm now going to tell you is that this theory actually makes sense up to energies of order only v. Or if we do it a little more accurately, there's a 4 pi v, which is a 4 pi m over g. Okay. So already there's something that breaks down at this much, much lower energy scale. So notice this energy scale is higher than the mass of the spin 1 particle, but it's definitely nowhere near the Planck scale. In the real world, these numbers are of order 100 GeV. The couplings are of order 1. So this scale is around the TeV, or 1.2 TeV. And it's what Jen referred to in his lecture yesterday as the unitarity bound, for reasons that will become obvious in a second. Okay, but why is it that things break down here? Well, the reason things break down there is that actually there's a discrete difference between the masses and the massive spin 1 particle, and the discrete difference is that there is a massive spin 1 particle has 3 degrees of freedom, while a massive spin 1 particle has 2. So there's one extra degree of freedom that a massive spin 1 particle has that the massless one does not. Okay. So, and that's actually the degree of freedom that we're interested to study. Okay. I'm interested in seeing what that degree of freedom does. Notice again, there's no such thing as gauge invariant. This Lagrangian is not gauge invariant. I don't care. Maybe if people haven't had this point hammered into their head, I'm happy to discuss it in later or maybe in the discussion session or something, but really, there's no such thing as gauge invariance. There's no such thing as spontaneous symmetry breaking. Instead, there's something much more interesting. So here, no, there's no gauge invariance. There's just a massive spin 1 particle. But I would like to study the extra degree of freedom that is involved when you have a massive spin 1 particle. Okay? There's this extra, there's 3 polarizations. There are the 2 transverse polarizations that you would have even for a massless spin 1 particle, but there's this one extra one. Okay. So if you go to very, very high energies, it's clear that that it would be useful to be able to disentangle the 2 transverse components that are there for a massless spin 1 particle. Okay. Those are the things where we can ignore the mass. But there's this one extra degree of freedom. How do we study the one extra degree of freedom? Well, we study the one extra degree of freedom by in a convenient way, by actually making this theory gauge invariant. You see, when we say gauge invariance is a fake, it really is a fake. You can take any theory that isn't gauge invariant and make it gauge invariant. Gauge invariance is an equivalence. It's a redundancy. It tells you that two theories related by a gauge transformation, sorry, two field configurations related by a gauge transformation are to be identified. Okay? It's a redundancy. And it's a redundancy which is very useful. It's a redundancy that's useful when you're describing massless spin one particles, because it allows you to describe the two polarizations of a massless spin one particle in a way that's manifestly local. Okay? So, you know, when you just have a massless spin one particle, you know that there's two polarizations, but if you want to describe it with a field, there's four components of a mu. So how do we make sure that how do we make sure that this theory is actually describing two degrees of freedom? Well, we might imagine that there are some polarization vectors that go along with this field epsilon mu. Okay? And we might try to say, well, the polarization vectors are transverse. So p nu epsilon mu is equal to zero. That's fine. That takes us from 4 to 3 degrees of freedom. But there's still one extra degree of freedom. And the difficulty is that if I have epsilon mu, then also epsilon mu plus anything times p mu is also a good polarization vector because p squared is equal to 0. Okay? So both of these satisfy p dot epsilon equals 0. So imposing p dot epsilon equals 0 just knocks me down to 3 degrees of freedom. In order to make sure I'm describing the 2 degrees of freedom, the 2 transverse helicities, I have to further say that this and this are the same configuration, are the same, they're identified. And this is nothing other than the momentum space version that a mu and a mu plus the derivative of something are identified. Okay? So it's an identification. It's not a symmetry. Everything is invariant under the gauge redundancy. Okay? It's just a convenient way of adding redundancy to a system in order for us to be able to describe the massless higher spin particles, and it starts at spin one in a convenient way. Okay. So that's what gauge redundancy is good for. It's just a convenience. But we want to study the transverse degrees of freedom of this massive spin one field. This isn't massless. This is massive. Okay? So there's no reason we have to do anything. In fact, this is the whole Lagrangian. We're just done. Okay? But I'm interested in studying what happens to the extra degree of freedom. So let me do that by the following simple trick. I'm going to make a gauge transformation. Okay. So a mu goes to u inverse v mu plus a mu u. Okay. That's a gauge transformation. This Lagrangian is evidently not gauge invariant, right? But I can make it gauge invariant just by saying that the u are fields. Okay. So I say that u, which is some e to the I, let me write it as pi a t a. I now say that u is a field. U is a field that transforms under gauge transformation like u goes to gu. Okay? Now it's gauge invariant. Basically, I just promoted the gauge transforming parameters to a field. Now it's gauge invariant. In fact, we can do this in a simpler example first just to see how dumb this is. Let's do it for just a single spin one particle. So let me write it the same way, though. So this is just m, so there's no indices here. Now, when I do a gauge transformation, I just say a mu goes to a mu plus d mu theta. So now I have a new Lagrangian, which is 1 over 4 g squared f mu nu squared plus v squared a mu plus d mu theta, or let me write it plus d mu pi squared. Okay. So it's not gauge invariant if pi is a parameter, but it is gauge invariant if I say a mu goes to a mu plus d mu lambda and pi goes to pi minus lambda. Now it's gauge invariant. Okay. You can always do this. You can take any theory that isn't gauge invariant, and because the gauge symmetry is a redundancy anyway, you can always add redundancy to make it gauge invariant. Okay, so this is all of a sudden gauge invariant. What is the point of doing this? Well, the original theory didn't have any redundancy. I've now introduced a gauge redundancy. What is the point of doing this? The point of, well, one, so in order to, I then have to fix the gauge, right? I've introduced a redundancy, I have to fix the gauge. One way of fixing the gauge is to set pi back to zero, and I go back to the original theory. Okay, so that's unitary gauge. But the point of doing this is that I can now fix the gauge in another way. Okay. I can fix the gauge in another way that makes the transverse components of the spin one field as decoupled as possible from the longitudinal component. So what I can do is, for example, fix some analog now of I can fix some analog of Lorentz gauge, for example. Or if you're a little more clever, these are the arc-c gauges, but it doesn't matter. Okay? So if you do that, then what I have is I have the theory of a mu and this one extra degree of freedom pi. Okay? So now I manifestly have the 3 degrees of freedom and I've split them up into the 2 transverse components and the 1 extra longitudinal component. So pi is the new, it's a new degree of freedom, the new degree of freedom that a massive spin one particle has that a massless spin one particle does not. Now, in this abelian theory, you see this is particularly nice. This pi is free. Okay. And this is the origin of the statement that people knew already in the 60s that massive QED is renormalizable in an old-fashioned language. But that's actually just a peculiarity of the abelian theory. Let's come back to this theory that we really care about. Well, if we do that, now something interesting happens. Because now the Lagrangian is, well, we just had it. It's minus 4g squared trace f mu squared plus v squared trace, let me write it as v mu u, d mu u dagger. Okay. But now I can decouple the transverse and the other part of the and the new part of the gauge field. So if I just want to study just longitudinal components, are these guys. Notice, too, here that the pi shifts under the gauge symmetry. That means that if I take lambda to just be a constant, pi has a shift symmetry on it, which means that pi always has to appear derivatively. So it's massless if I ignore the rest of these interactions. So we sometimes call them Goldstones because that's exactly what Goldstone bosons do. They shift under the broken symmetries, and that's what guarantees that they're massless. So in this non-abelian case, we just have a non-abelian generalization of that. So u goes to u times g certainly begins as pi a goes to pi a plus some constant a plus dot, dot, dot. Okay? So the pi's are also massless. But if I now just want to study the longitudinal components, the degree, the Lagrangian for just the pi's is just given by v squared trace d mu u, d mu u dagger. Okay. So again, I just ignore the a mu, and I just look at the new degree of freedom. Okay. That's what describes the longitudinal components of the spin one particle. By the way, we can say this a little more formally in both cases. If we just want to focus on the longitudinal degrees of freedom, The really formal thing we can do is to send the gauge coupling to zero, keeping V fixed. V equals M over G fixed. Okay. In this limit, they really decouple completely. In this limit, the transverse and the longitudinal components decouple completely. G goes to zero. This is all I have left. All right, but unlike that case where the longitudinal degree of freedom was free, here the pi's are interacting. This Lagrangian is called the nonlinear signal model. I'll write it again. And clearly, when I expand it out, it has an infinite number of higher dimension operators. Okay? So this theory doesn't make sense all by itself. This theory breaks down at high energies. At what energy scale does it break down? Well, clearly, there's only one dimensional scale here, V. So V is the scale where this theory breaks down. As I go up in energy, here is the scale V. If you're a little bit more careful, it's really 4 pi times V. And I can explain where the 4 pi comes from later. But the 4 pi is just related to the 16 pi squares in loops. Okay. So, but anyway, I'll explain that in a bit. But anyway, so up here, we don't know what's going on. Down here, though, I have this nonlinear signal model. And it's perfectly nice and well-behaved. Then I'd have to add higher dimension operators. Okay. And of course, here is the scale GV, the mass of the gauge boson. Okay. Beneath this scale, down here, this is a very, I can continue to use this gauge if I want, but it's very inconvenient. Okay. Because down here, really, the transverse and the longitudinal components are at low energies compared to the mass of the particles, there isn't much point making a distinction. But this, in this range, the longitudinal components are very nicely described by the nonlinear signal model. Very good. So this is the real issue then. The real issue is when we have massive spin 1 particles, the longitudinal components become strongly interacting when they're non-abelian. They become strongly interacting at a scale 4 pi m over g. Beneath that scale, everything is totally fine. This is why we've managed to go so far with the standard model without having discovered the Higgs, while making precision, percentage, 10 to the minus 3 level agreement between theory and experiment and everything. Why can we do that when we haven't seen the Higgs? Well, really, the theory that we're probing is this theory, okay. Just the theory of the massive spin 1 particle and nothing else, with an exception that I'll come to in a second. But this theory is predicting its own demise. Okay? Something must come in beyond what we've seen. The physics has got to start changing qualitatively by the scale of 4 pi V. Yes? Who said the theories were normalizable? I didn't use the words were normalizable. This is the point. That logic is not always correct. Okay. No. They're beautifully decoupled in this limit. They're beautifully decoupled. That's not the problem. The problem is that this apparently naively renormalizable theory is not. Okay. And technically, it's because if you stick a unitary gauge, the usual argument of renormalizability, which relies on propagators falling off fast enough, breaks down because there is this k nu over m squared piece in the propagator. Okay, but that's a very technical way of saying it. This is the physical way of saying it. The physical way of saying it is the theory actually has a new degree of freedom, and the effect of Lagrangian for that new degree of freedom is not renormalized. Okay, that effect of Lagrangian breaks down at the scale of 4 pi d. Yes, that's just what we're talking about in a second. So the name of the game then is we have to have something to complete this theory. Something above the scale. So we need a UV completion. Okay. This is where the Higgs comes in. So what we need is a theory that gives to us at low energies the nonlinear signal model, but is itself complete to much higher energies. Now, the nonlinear signal model is just the universal theory that describes, well, that has this, that has the, that has the symmetries that we talked about. In particular, that has a shift symmetry on the pies. So the most naive thing is to come up with a linear signal model, a Higgs model, in the ultraviolet, and that has spontaneous symmetry breaking and produces these Goldstone bosons. Okay? So UV completion 1 is the linear signal model, where we get this out of a Higgs model. Okay? So we have h dagger h minus d squared squared. Okay? And let's see how this works. The physical mass of the Higgs particle, as Jim reviewed, is lambda times v squared. So what's going on in this theory is, here is the scale 4 pi v. Here's the mass of the physical Higgs particle, which is root lambda times v. And now, when I integrate out the physical Higgs particle, now at very low energies, all I see are the Goldstone bosons. Okay? And that's described by the nonlinear signal model. Okay. So as I go to high energies, first, I see the Higgs, and really, there's nothing happening at the scale 4 pi v. Okay, that's an imaginary scale that's inferred purely from the low energy theory. But before the low energy theory has a chance to get strongly coupled, as we go to high energies, we see the Higgs instead. By the way, and I'm giving at least the answer to Jim's question, although you should do it the way he asked you to really see the magic of this. Here, if we look at the amplitude for Goldstone scattering, so this is the longitudinal components of the spin 1 particle. Well, we just get it from dimensional analysis here. Okay? The leading interaction has two derivatives in it, so it goes like this amplitude goes like e squared over v squared. Okay. That's, by the way, so if we look at a physical cross section, there would be 1 over 16 pi squareds in it, and that's why the cutoff is of order 4 pi v. That's when the amplitudes actually become of order 1. Okay. But anyway, I'm being sloppy about the 4 pi for a moment. So this amplitude just gets strongly coupled to the scale 4 pi v, for example. And it's just one indication that we have no idea what's going on. Hey, Graham. Okay, so let's now go back here. What's going on here is that at this lower scale, root lambda v, so to the extent that root lambda is much smaller than 4 pi, or lambda is much smaller than 16 pi squared, the theory is weakly coupled. Okay? And... And in fact, this theory itself, as Jim also reviewed, can break down in the ultraviolet. Okay? For example, if lambda is large, the theory isn't asymptotically free. So there is some scale that this theory is going to break down, but that's exponentially large. It's either the 1 over 16 pi squared over lambda times v. This is like a Landau pole scale. So what the Higgs UV completion is buying us is a much larger window of energies where the theory makes sense. Okay. And also, and it does so by changing the nonlinear signal model earlier than it's absolutely needs to be UV completed. We can see, for example, that the scattering amplitude, which is for the gold zones, which is E squared over V squared, becomes as large as M Higgs squared over V squared. That's the biggest it ever gets. Okay? And what is that? Well, this is a Bordeaux lambda. So I have this low energy gold zone scattering. It starts growing, growing. But before it becomes a Bordeaux 1, something changes when it becomes a Bordeaux lambda. Well, that's exactly right. Because above the scale lambda, it sees, oh, I'm actually friends with the Higgs. With the Higgs, we're part of a multiplet. And what are our scattering amplitudes? Well, it's just the quarter coupling, lambda. So that's exactly what the answer is. Okay, so this is what the Higgs completion is buying for us. It lets us have a theory that makes sense to way, way higher energies. Okay. Now, that buys us a lot more. Oh, sorry. Let me say one more thing. When we say, as Jim explained, that precision electroweak physics favors what the Higgs is like, that's really a statement that can be rephrased as a statement purely about this nonlinear signal model. In other words, it's really a statement that we don't expect that we have indirect evidence that the cutoff, the actual physical cutoff on this nonlinear signal model is much lower than the scale of 4 pi v. Okay? In the particular case of the Higgs model, it tells us the Higgs should be light. This is the physical cutoff. Okay? But that actual statement is independent of whether it's the Higgs model or something else. And it arises from the fact that this low energy Lagrangian, we started off with v squared trace d nu u, d nu u dagger, okay, which has this extended symmetry under u goes to any left u right dagger, any matrices of that form. But this symmetry is actually broken. It's broken by the top Yukawa coupling. It's broken by hypercharge. And so there are actually other operators that one can also have, which are induced at loop level in this effective theory. Okay, there are operators like W mu nu, u dagger, w mu nu, u b mu nu, for example. This is a mixing between the w and the b, which I think Jim talked about again in the context of the Higgs model. Or there's something that looks like trace t3 u dagger d mu u all squared. So these are operators that are there that actually get induced. And not only are they induced, they're induced logarithmically. So even though we don't know exactly what the cutoff is of this ahead of time, what the cutoff of this nonlinear signal model is, if we imagine that the cutoff is some lambda, and we run down to the z mass, mz, where these precision observables were measured, there are corrections to both of these operators, this one and that one, that are proportional to the log of the cutoff over mz squared. They're running. Okay. So they grow logarithmically, weakly, but they still grow as the cutoff gets bigger and bigger. But because they're logarithms, they're computable. They're computable, they're running effects in the low energy theory. And this is where these strong precision electroweak limits come from, because these operators are computable. They have signs, for example, which are computable. And the signs and the magnitude both go the wrong way as you make the cutoff bigger and bigger. As you make the cutoff bigger and bigger, they take you further and further away logarithmically, but still further and further away from agreement with experiment. Okay. So we see that there's no hint. Of course, it could be that there's a cancellation between the running contribution and some other contribution that comes from the scale lambda. But that would take some conspiracy. Okay. Without any conspiracy, just this low energy contribution and the low energy chiral Lagrangian would move you away from this low energy Lagrangian, move you away from agreement with experiment, unless the cutoff is very low, unless the cutoff is really close to the Z. In the Higgs model, what plays a role at the cutoff is the physical Higgs mass. And so these are the corrections that Jim was talking about, where you got log mH squared over mz squared, for example. Okay. But it's really a more general statement. We have indirect evidence that the logs in this low energy effective Lagrangian are not large, which means that it probably does not make sense all the way up to 4 pi v. In fact, it probably doesn't make sense much above a few hundred GeV. So that's really indirect evidence that the theory that UV completes these nonlinear signal model fields is weakly coupled. Because something new happens before those scattering amplitudes have a chance to become large. Okay. And so that's the, yes?
Can you explain why this is so different from the diagram? You're saying that you have here this strong coupling area.
So the reason these operators are special is because this is the S parameter operator, this is the T parameter operator. The reason these operators are special is because they affect the quadratic part of the gauge boson action in unitary gauge. Okay, so if I put U equals one, this first operator turns into a mixing between W3 and B mu nu, for example. The second turns into just the mass for the W, for example, and not the mass for the Z. Okay?
Yeah, roughly speaking.
Okay? So these operators can be measured at the Z-pole. This is what Jim's been talking about. Okay? The reason they can be measured is because we're measuring precisely these kinematic on-shell properties at the Z-pole. So these quadratic corrections we're very sensitive to. And so these things were measured at the per mil level. So this is roughly speaking why the logarithm can't be big. If I can just say it quickly, these things have been measured to 10 to the minus 3 level. You would expect that there's deviations at 10 to the minus 2 level times the log even. Okay. So the fact that they've been measured at 10 to the minus 3 level tells you the log can't be very big. If I took this up to 1.2 TeV, then these things would start being about a factor of 4 bigger than the than what's allowed. So I don't want to re-give Jim's lecture, obviously. I just wanted to say that it's really a more general statement. These big corrections, big logarithmic, but still, the reason they're telling us something very important is because they're a universal property of the theory of the longitudinal modes of the W and the Z. Okay? And they're telling us that theory is not getting, that's not running very far. As I take that theory into the UV, something new is happening very early. Again, in the case of the Higgs model, it's telling us that the Higgs would have to be light. But you can imagine more complicated or other UV completions, and what's really telling us is that it's weakly coupled. Okay, and that's very, very important because let me come back to why that's important in a sec. Let's see. So let's go back to the Higgs model. So if we take the Higgs model, then the theory can make sense. Then the ultimate UV cutoff can be very far away, can be huge. And as Jim reviewed, it could be all the way up to the Gott or the Planck scale without a problem, as long as the Higgs quarter coupling is in a certain window. Okay. Now, this has additional benefits, because in this, what we've seen in nature is all kinds of accidental symmetries. Baryon number, lepton number are accidental symmetries. CP is almost an accidental symmetry. It's broken very, very weakly. We have flavor, and so on. Okay. There's a huge number of approximate symmetries. And all of these symmetries can be understood in one fell swoop as following simply from the fact that if the cutoff is large, the low energy theory beneath the cutoff, so here's scale land with UV, the low energy theory down here is renormalizable plus power series in 1 over lambda UV. And so up to tiny effects, we have accidental symmetries, which are the symmetries of this of just the standard one. So let's again review what they are. So there's baryon and lepton number. Okay. So baryon and lepton number are, well, because for example, an operator that would violate baryon number, I can have it, but it would involve, for example, 3 quarks and a lepton divided by some scale squared. This violates baryon. Okay. It would give you proton decay. Here's an operator that violates lepton number between a lepton and a Higgs. That violates lepton number, and it gives us neutrino masses that are even correct. If I put roughly correct if the scale n is high, if I put the Higgs to its bath, this gives me neutrino masses that go like b squared over m. But at zeroth order, the fact that lepton number is pretty good is certainly explained by that. Those are quite familiar. There's also the fact that the standard model has three generations. So we have three sets of and we have 5 different kinds of fields with different quantum numbers, the quarks and the leptons. But there's a limit, and I have interactions that look like this. I have the Yukawa couplings. But in the limit, they turn off all the Yukawa couplings. There's a large U3 to the 5th global symmetry. There's a U3 that acts on the Qs. There's a U3 that acts on the Us, the Vs separately. Okay, so let's call this U3 to the 5th. And the only thing that breaks U3 to the 5th, the only thing that breaks U3 to the 5th, so are the Yukawa matrices. Okay. So I just have, so lambda U, DE break U3 to the 5th, but in a very particular way, right? So I can think about lambda U, for example, which has a, let's say it has a Q index and a UC index. I can think of this as a 3-3 or a 3-3 bar under U3Q cross U3U. Okay. So if I assign lambda U transformation properties under U3Q cross U3U, then everything would be still U3 to the 5th in there. Or said another way, lambda U is a sporion for U3Q cross U3U that transforms as the 3-3 bar. So this is a very controlled way in which this flavor symmetry is broken. And that has many consequences in the standard model. Okay. So for example, all of the various, all the various flavor changing processes that we've seen. Oh, and by the way, as I turn on those Yukawa matrices, the U3 to the fifth is broken, so there is an explicitly a U1 baryon, and then U1 lepton numbers for E, mu, and tau are left. But still, what controls flavor violation is directly these Yukawa matrices. So there's all kinds of flavor changing processes in the standard model. So things like there's KK bar, mixing, and its friend BB bar mixing, BB bar mixing, B to S gamma. Anyway, a whole slew of flavor changing processes. And all of the operators that contribute to these processes are controlled by this flavor symmetry. Said another way, there's a large flavor symmetry, and the Yukawa matrices pick out directions in preferred directions in the flavor space. But they're the only preferred directions in the flavor space. That fact explains why so many of these flavor changing processes are comparatively small, or well, we compute them. They are what they are. The standard model agrees with experiment. But it's easy to see that they could turn out to be a lot larger. Let me do one quick example. For instance, let's talk about the most famous old example, KK bar mix. So KK bar mixing, microscopically in the standard model, comes from this sort of diagram. W's. And the off charm and top quarks in the loop. And we phrase it in terms of KM mixing and so on. But let's actually say this in a more symmetry language. Using the U3 to the fifth, let me make an important point here. This tells us that, for example, lambda U dagger is only charged under U3Q, right? As an adjoint under U3Q. So is lambda D dagger. It's an adjoint under U3Q. Okay. Everything else is, for example, lambda U dagger, the other way around, lambda U dagger, lambda U, is an adjoint under U3E. U3U, get lambda T dagger, lambda D, is an adjoint under U3D. Okay. But you then see that because these are the only two matrices that are actually charged into the same U3, all of the flavor violation in the standard model comes from the fact that these two matrices are not diagonal on the same basis. Okay. So that's the KM matrix. The KM matrix is the relative diagonalization between lambda U dagger and lambda D dagger. Okay. So, but now let's go look to see what that operator actually is. So what can we actually generate? Well, because everything only involves U3Q is the only thing that will because U3Q is the only thing that has two different matrices charged under it, the only flavor-violating operators we can get in the standard model involve the left-handed cubes. For instance, I can never get an operator, any operator that I might get just out of the right-handed fields would have to have its flavor indices contracted with, let's say, right-handed upfields would have to have its flavor indices contracted with lambda u dagger lambda u. Okay? And that means in the basis where this is diagonal, that would be diagonal. It's only things made out of U3 cube that have a chance to be off-diagonal. And so let's do that example. So that example would be, for example, let me put the flavor indices here. Okay. But now, because lambda u dagger is charged under Q, I can soak up these indices with lambda u dagger. A B lambda u dagger. Or I can do, let's see, B D lambda u dagger. A B, sorry. B C. Okay. All right, so this is something. So whatever I have must be proportional to this in the numerator, just by the U3Q symmetry. And now when I go to mass eigenstate basis and I want to pick out of here the d bar sigma bar mu s, d sigma mu s bar, what am I going to pick out? I'm going to pick out 4 powers of some lambdas, and in fact that would be lambda charm to the fourth. And then some Khabibo angle, the 1-2 angle squared, in order to take me from down to S. Okay. Now, in fact, in reality, there's an interesting subtlety in the standard model, which is that the diagrams that contribute to the diagrams that contribute to flavor changing processes. Actually, typically, often have light particles running around with them. So here, for example, there's a charm quark running around. In fact, if I integrate out the W first, I have this sort of diagram. Okay? And this sort of diagram has these light fermions running around in it. So in fact, it has an infrared divergence. It has an infrared divergence, which is cut off by the charm quark mass itself. So that actually gives me. So I necessarily need this numerator structure, but I get actually an infrared enhancement. I get some lambda charm squared downstairs from the fact that there's light charms in the loop. So that in the end of the day, the whole thing is proportional to m charm squared, theta Khabibo squared. This is the famous result for KK bar mixed. But I want to just emphasize that this is coming from something that's actually tiny. It's minuscule. The flavor violations are controlled by the tiny Yukawa couplings. And actually, the only reason that we get to see any of it is because there are light particles running around that pick up these IR enhancements. Okay, but this is how U3 of the fifth controls, for example, KK bar mixing in the standard model. By the way, something very similar happens also with CP violation. So CP is only violated, again, to the degree, the only places where I can have CP violation are in the Yukawa matrices in the standard model. And I have to make out of the Yukawa matrices some quantity, which is some U3Q invariant quantity, which has a non-trivial phase in it. So the only way I can do that is the simplest thing you can think of. For example, if you take lambda u dagger, lambda d dagger, you take the trace, for example. That's not, that's real, because these are all real Hermitian matrices. To get a phase is a little hard, and in fact, the leading thing that has a phase in it is the determinant of the commutator between lambda u dagger and lambda d dagger. Okay. So So this is a quantity that's U3Q invariant. That's U3Q invariant. Okay. Its imaginary part is the only CP violating thing in the standard model. There's one number, and this is it. This is called the Yarlskog invariant. And so you see, CP violation in the standard model is minuscule. It's proportional to all these tiny U-Powell couplings. The actual magnitude of the CP violation is also order 10 to the minus 7, or smaller. Okay. So how come we see all these nice CP violating things in the K-on system, in the B factories, and so on, okay, which are more like a percent, or 10 to the minus 3 level things at a dimensionless level? It's for the same reason. All of those quantities involve IR enhancements in exactly the same way. So there's some CP violating quantity that's proportional to Yarlskog upstairs, but it gets all these IR enhancements downstairs. For example, in the case of the KK bar system, there's all these magnitudes of lambdas downstairs, just like we saw here, that make them bigger. So the bottom line of all of this is that the fact that flavor is controlled by these, there's a U3 to the fifth symmetry that's only broken by the U-Powell couplings, tells us that the intrinsic size of flavor violation in the standard model is really tiny. And it gets a little bigger because of infrared enhancements and the light particles running around the loops. But the actual size is really, really tiny. OK. But this, too, this fact is also guaranteed. This fact is also guaranteed by the approximate renormalizable nature of the theory. Okay, again, I could imagine that beneath this cutoff scale lambda, I could imagine that there are operators like this one, like just directly, q bar 2 sigma bar q 1 squared, okay, over lambda squared. Okay, this is a very bad operator. We'll give you KK bar mixing. A lot of KK bar mixing. It's gauge invariant. There's no reason not to write it down. Okay, but the standard model, or the Higgs UV completion, up to a very high scale lambda means that these things are suppressed by incredibly tiny, are incredibly tiny. So the only thing that breaks flavor at a normalizable level are the U-Powell matrices, and so everything else follows. Okay, we can quantify this a little more. And now I can, okay, so it's flavor and CP and baryon number and lepton number. All of these things, the most dramatic are baryon and lepton number, but many more numerous are flavor and CP issues. Okay? And all of those things in one fell swoop are just explained by UV completion that has a standard model making sense up to energies that are way, way above the TED scale. Okay? And as Jim explained, it could be all the way up to the gut scale without any problem. Let me quantify this a little more. This is what I wanted to say. If we just think about the standard model now, by the standard model, I now mean with the Higgs. Okay. If we take the standard model, and we now look at all the dimension 5 and 6 operators beyond the standard model, we can see what the, if we just write down operators like 1 over cutoff squared, we can see what the limits on those cutoffs are. Okay, just what the experimental limits on those cutoffs are. Let me summarize them. So let's first just categorize what they look like, just roughly. So the dimension five operators. Well, I can have dimension five operators that look, for example, there's the one that we talked about that gives us. Neutrino masses, and that's it at dimension 5. At dimension 6, we start having a whole bunch of interesting operators. Let me focus on the ones that, let me break them up into various categories. So what does it take to get dimension 6? So, for example, I can have 4 fermion operators. Okay. So these could include the operators that I just mentioned, right? So, but let me first just talk about what they are. I can have four Fermion operators. I can have things that look like, that involve a Higgs. So this already has dimension 4, and then I can make gauge invariants like that. So these are, so this is 4 Fermi and magnetic or electric moments. And I can have I can also have turrets between the standard model fermions and the Higgses. Okay, so these are the kinds of operators I can have at the dimension 6. Oh, there's another one you can have at dimension 6, which is like trace F mu nu squared. F mu cubed, for example, or trace G, G dual G. But that's basically the list of all the kinds of dimension 6 operators that you can have. But let's now talk about the what the sort of constraints on them are. Again, categorized by whether or not they break some of these approximate symmetries. Okay, so the constraints on the baryon and lepton number violating operators are that the scale is above, you know, anywhere from 10 to the 14 to 16 GeV. Okay, so these are operators like Q, Q, QL, for example, like we just talked about, or so baryon and lepton number, there's definitely either the standard model is valid up to 10 to the 14 or 10 to the 16 GeV, or if it isn't, something has got to explain why these operators aren't there. So the second you say that the standard model is not valid up to 10 to the up to these very high energies, you just lose the automatic explanation for why baryon and lepton number are not violated along, just as a general fact. Okay. But then. So those are the most severe ones. We can then go on to the things that break U3 to the fifth. So if I just write down the operators, like I said, like let me write it, d bar s squared, for example, or ds conjugate squared. I'm suppressing a lot of the index structure. Okay. These things, they're real parts. The cutoffs have got to be bigger than between, you know, 300 to 3,000 TeV. And their imaginary parts have got to be bigger than around 10 times that, 3,000, 30,000 TeV. Okay. These operators. There's a similar story for, so this comes from KK bar mixing. So again, this is the fact that these scales are so high is reflecting how weakly flavors are broken in the standard model itself, and also, but the fact that that agrees with experiment tells us these scales have got to be very, very far away. Anyway, all the work in the V factories up to about 2004, actually, very nice advance happened around 2004, but it used to be to the limits that KK bar mixing had the best limits on these operators. Okay? After the B factories are giving us comparably good limits on these operators as we get from KK bar. So these are operators like B bar D squared or B D conjugates squared. Okay? So it's similar. But there are other things. DD bar mixing gives us the analogous things on C's and U's. Okay? And these are about a factor of 10 weaker. Okay? There are operators that look like some of the dimension 6 operators. If I put the Higgs to its bev, turn into things that look like mu bar sigma bar mu nu e f mu nu, for example. So I put a bev over lambda squared here. Okay. Then limits on these operators are very, very strong. They're well in excess of these, actually. There's a fair way of doing accounting on these coefficients that let me not go into. That makes it sort of comparable. Finally, bottom line, the limits from flavor changing and neutral occurrence are that the cutoffs are bigger than, you know, between 100 and 10 to the 4 TeV, depending on what we're talking about. There's CP violation the most direct. So let's say we have the operator E conjugate sigma mu nu E F mu nu. So this looks like a dimension 5 operator, but really it had to come from a Higgs bev. So there's a bev upstairs here, that's lambda squared. And, well, this is the accounting I was talking about a second ago. Also, this operator breaks the chiral symmetries acting on the electron. So really, it's fair to include here an electron-Yukawa coupling. So this really turns into an M electron over lambda squared, E conjugate sigma mu nu, E F mu nu. But I can have this operator or the analogous one with F twiddle mu nu. Okay. The one with F twiddle mu nu violates CP. And, for example, gives me an electric dipole moment for the electron, okay? Which I can just estimate by dimensional analysis as just being literally this coefficient. Okay? So this is ME over lambda squared. That has the direct units times this coefficient. Well, so I'm just writing it down with the coefficient over lambda squared. And, well, we know experimentally that the electric dipole moment is less than 10 to the minus 27 e centimeters of the electron. And so that tells us that this lambda is bigger than about 100 TeV. Okay. Sorry? Yeah, this is, if I have this operator with the coefficient, I'm telling you what the coefficient lambda would have. Okay. Yes, that's right. So this is all, again, this is very nice because the standard model predicts basically zero. So let me say this. So what does the standard model predict for this? The standard model prediction for dE over E is like 10 to the minus, I forget what it is. Maybe you guys, I think it's 10 to the minus 34 E centimeters. Okay. And where does that minuscule number come from? It comes because the CP violation in the standard model has this big Jarlskog in front of it. Okay. So it's the tiny, tiny, tiny number. That's why it's, so this is a reflection of how good CP is in the standard model and how easy it is to screw up beyond the standard model. There's a similar thing for the neutron. Okay, that's less than 10 to the minus 25 e centimeters by now. Okay, and there's a similar limit on the analogous operator. Okay. So CP from EDMs tells us that these lambdas are bigger than about 100 TeV. Okay. Now we keep going, and finally there are operators that actually don't violate any of the symmetries of the set. So these are all things that either that violated the accidental symmetries of the standard model. Finally, there are operators that don't violate any of the accidental symmetries of the standard model, but which we've still been probing, like contact interactions, E bar sigma bar mu E squared over cutoff squared, for example. That's a contact interaction between electrons. Okay. Okay, these things, analogous operators, LEP2, in the lepton sector, looked at these things and told us that the cutoff has to be bigger than about 5 dB. Okay. More interesting, an interesting one, well, okay. There are other operators then that finally involve the Higgs. For example, the Higgs current times any fermion current. Okay. This is an interesting operator. These are interesting operators because anything involving the Higgs current, this actually directly modifies the coupling of the fermions to the Z. Because notice that the Higgs current in unitary gauge exactly goes to B squared Z mu. So that's exactly the thing that becomes the massive gauge bar. So the things that look like Higgs current times J mu directly affect the couplings of the fermions. Okay. The only mercy is that the is proportional to B squared. So it has an extra B squared over lambda squared in front of it. But still, these things tell us that lambda is between, depending on who you're talking about, 5 and 10. And finally, if you do Jim's exercise from yesterday, there are operators like h dagger dμh squared, for example, or h dagger w mu nu h b mu nu. Okay. And these are, again, in excess of 10 dB or so. Ah, and finally, so this is the tour of all the dimension 6 operators. Finally, there's these guys. The trace glue cube doesn't do very much. The trace glue glue dual glue does. That violates CP as well. And the coefficient of that operator would also contribute to an EDM for the neutron, for example, and it's got to be about 10 TeV or so. Yeah. Okay. So really, there's a much more detailed story. The reason I divided these operators up like this, for example, these guys are stronger than these guys by about a factor of 10, it turns out. And it's interesting because these are the operators that are generated in the standard model. So there's much more dangerous operators. They're more dangerous because their matrix elements tend to be bigger. They're bigger by NC factors. They also run as you go from high energies down to low. And the running, just the QCD running, tends to enhance them further. So there's a real spread. So the so-called left-left type operators tend to have a factor of 10 weaker constraints on left-right type operators. And it's the left-left ones that are generated in the standard model. OK, but this should give you a global picture of where we are now. OK, so we have the standard. So all we know is we have the W and the Z. Let me recapitulate. All we know is we have the W and the Z so far directly. That theory by itself must break down beneath the 1.2 TeV scale, because that's where the longitudinal components of the W and Z become strongly coupled and need some UV completion for them. Okay? That's all we know for straight fact. However, we have indirect evidence that this effect of Lagrangian that describes the longitudinal components has a low cutoff, much lower than 4 pi V, which has to do with the fact that there are these precision corrections which grow logarithmically in this low energy Carrier-Lagrange, in this low energy Goldstone theory, which push you even the wrong way. They have fixed signs, magnitude signs, and they just go in every case in the wrong direction relative to what the data wants. Which is why, even though it's only a logarithmic sensitivity, it's enough to tell us that unless there's an accidental cancellation between some other contribution to these operators, that purely the running contribution can't be running for very far. So the cutoff of this effective low energy Goldstone Lagrangian must be low. And because it's low, it tells us that whatever the theory that UV completes them must be weakly coupled. Okay, so that's the first take-home message. And secondly, if it's weakly coupled and if its completion is a weakly coupled Higgs model that makes sense up to very high energies, that gives us an immediate explanation for the remarkable success of the standard model in controlling, in explaining all the accidental symmetries that we've seen. Everywhere from the most almost perfect accidental symmetries, like baryon and lepton number, down to the dirtier, more detailed, but still very interesting ones involving flavor. Okay? So there's all these accidental symmetries. They're all explained by having this renormalizable standard model, Lagrangian. And if I just took the, if I took the collection of all these things and I was as dumb as possible, I would say, let me put the cutoff at 10,000 TeV or more. Right? If I put it at 10,000 TeV or more, all of these things are nicely explained. I don't have to think about it. And certainly, it looks consistent to have it make sense all the way up to much higher energies. Okay? Okay, so any questions about this? This is a very long motivation, but I think it's important to have. I never said the word vocal symmetry. No, I just had massive spin one fields. I never said the word local symmetry. There's no such thing. I didn't require anything. I introduced the U's in order to help me describe the longitudinal components in a convenient way. And I noticed that they have that structure. So, yes? Well, the fact that it has that left-right symmetry, I should have said this, that reflects the fact that I put in, to begin with, a triplet of matrix spin 1 fields that had an SU2 global symmetry acting on them. No one forced me to do that. I could put in a triplet where two of them had a different mass than the third one. Okay, and then there would not be that global symmetry. But that global symmetry that I put in by hand was reflected in this LUR dagger symmetry. That's the custodial symmetry of the standard model. I should have used the words earlier. Okay, that's the custodial symmetry. And it's just it's an empirical fact. It appears to be true that there is this custodial symmetry and that it's only broken by the top-Vicalis coupling and by hyperchar. That's another one of the symmetries. I should have mentioned it. The custodial symmetry is another thing which is automatic in the standard model. Okay? Because again, the renormalizable theory for a Higgs doublet accidentally has a bigger SO4 symmetry. So really it has SU2, but because the potential is a function of H dagger H, and H dagger H is H0 squared plus H1 squared plus H2 squared plus H3 squared, so that happens to have an SO4 symmetry, which is SU2 cross SU2. So it has more symmetry than it should, and that's also an automatic consequence of just the standard. Okay, so. Yes.
The parameter you love it. How can I make quantum collection of Higgs mass too small?
How can you?
Quantum collection of Higgs mass.
Yes.
How can it be small?
Oh, well, that's just what we're talking about. That's what we're going to be talking about. Okay. So why anything beyond the standard model? Why anything? Why BSM? Okay. Well, people have been thinking about this for a long time, and there's two reasons, exactly two reasons. One reason is from cosmology. And it's that the weakly interacting particles at the TeV scale are the only calculable candidate for dark matter that we have today. Okay. What do I mean by calculable? Well, there are lots of theories for what dark matter particles can be. Make up any particle you want that doesn't cool very much, that doesn't have very big self interactions, so that it can just virialize and be the big halo. Make it not charged, and whatever its mass is, pick its number density to work. So that's fine. Then you can give it fancy names. You can call it an axion or a gravitino, but in the end, that's what you do. You put in, you take its mass, you pick the abundance that gives you the right value. So it's not calculable. It doesn't matter. That might be the way things are, but there is no actual theory to predict it. There's only one thing where there is a very natural theory to predict it, and which gives a very nice answer. Okay, which is to imagine that there was some neutral particle that was once in thermal equilibrium with everyone else, so that means that's nice because thermal equilibrium immediately tells us that we know whenever you deal with cosmology, there's always a question of initial conditions. What are the initial conditions? And what's nice here is if we assume that it was once in thermal equilibrium, we know everything about it. We know its abundance relative to everything else because everything was in thermal equilibrium. Okay, so imagine here's the mass of the particle. Here's the very early universe when the temperature is high. When the temperature is high, this particle is in equilibrium. That means there are some interactions between dark matter particles and ordinary particles, others, standard model particles, let's say, that keep it in thermal equilibrium. Okay. Now, if instead of having an expanding universe, you just had a box, say you had a big box, and you heated up the box a lot, okay? You heated up the box past the temperature M, then you would see, hey, you start making the particle M, and it's in thermal equilibrium. Great, so now you've made it. Now let's dial the temperature back down. What would happen as you dial the temperature back down by hand is, well, the number density of this guy would be the same until it hit M, and then it would start getting Boltzmann suppressed. Okay? And it gets Boltzmann suppressed, why? Because, well, two of these dark matter particles at low temperature will occasionally run into each other and annihilate the ordinary particles. But the reverse process happens very rarely, because there isn't that much energy around. It only happens along the tail of the Boltzmann distribution of the particles that have enough energy to make it back. Okay, and what would happen if you just stood there and gradually dialed the temperature down slowly by slowly by slowly, is the number density of these guys would go to zero. As the temperature went to zero, the number density would go to zero. The expanding universe is a little different than just dialing down the temperature, because not only is the temperature going down, but everything is becoming more dilute at the same time. And what happens eventually is that it becomes so dilute that this process of two of them finding each other to annihilate to standard model particles can't happen. They're too dilute for it to happen. When does that happen? That happens when the mean free path becomes comparable to the Hubble. Then they just can't, then before they find each other, the expansion is just driving them apart, and they'll never find each other, and you're left with what you got. Okay, now if they have this annihilation cross section sigma, the mean free path is around 1 over n sigma. There's a velocity factor there, but anyway, everything is roughly relativistic, so this is 1 over n sigma, where n is the number density.
Yeah.
I'm assuming they're stable. So I'm assuming they're stable, so the only way you're getting rid of them is through annihilation. Okay. So it's when 1 over L is comparable to Hubble then, when that happens, the number density doesn't go down any further. Okay. So there's some critical N star, such that N star sigma is around H. Now N was T cubed e to the minus the Boltzmann path, right? So M over T. So and Hubble at a temperature T is around T squared over M Planck, because the universe is there, we're imagining it's still radiation dominated when this happens. So H squared is G Newton times rho. This is 1 over M Planck squared times temperature of the fourth. Okay, so this tells us that T cubed e to the minus m over t sigma has got to be comparable to t squared over m Planck. Okay. And so I can solve for the temperature where this happens. Clearly the temperatures around is a little less than m. This thing is shutting down exponentially, so the temperature is a little less than m. So let me just solve for e to the minus m over t here is 1 over t sigma m Planck. But clearly, I can solve for this exponentially tiny factor by approximating T by M in this formula. So M sigma M Planck. OK? And that then tells me that the energy density in the dark matter particle, when it no longer is diluting more, which is just m times its number density. This is m t cubed e to the minus m over t. And this is So let me not try to keep track of this logarithm in real time. So t over m is around 1 over log of m sigma m Planck. Okay? So the temperature is a little bit lower than the mass of the particle by this logarithmic factor. So rho dark matter is m times t cubed e to the minus m over t. Okay, and so this is m t squared over sigma m Planck. Okay, just from this first formula. Okay, and a nice quantity to look at always in cosmology is rho compared to t cubed, because this is doesn't change with time. Rho goes down like 1 over r cubed. The temperature goes down like 1 over r. So this is an invariant quantity. So this is then m over t, 1 over sigma m Planck, which is log m sigma m Planck over sigma m Planck. OK, now this quantity is the same back then as it is today, because it doesn't change with time. And well, we know observationally what rho dark matter over t cubed needs to be today. This needs to be around 10 to the minus 3 electron volt. That's the relevant scale. So from that, we can figure out what sigma is. There's this weak logarithmic dependence on m, but from that, we can figure out directly what sigma is. And what works very beautifully is sigma of order 10 to the minus 17 centimeters squared. Okay, well, and that's a weak scale cross section. So this is an argument purely from cosmology, and again, it has some weak dependence on the mass. But this is purely an argument from cosmology that a weakly interacting particle with mass of order hundreds of GeV makes a very nice dark matter candidate. And as I said, it's the only calculable. So that's one reason to have new physics. And the second reason that we will pick up within the afternoon is the hierarchy problem. Now, this reason is very nice, but it actually gives you a pretty decent sized range for what the mass of the dark matter particle should be. And furthermore, it tells you something about a weakly interacting particle. Okay? There's got to be a weakly interacting particle with these properties. For example, here's the world's dumbest model of dark matter. The world's dumbest model of dark matter is to just say that there is actually, I'll leave this as one of the exercises for you, to come up with the world's dumbest model of dark matter. But let me just tell you one of them. You'll be hard-pressed to make it dumber than this one. So let's say you just have some fermion, which is a doublet with hypercharge a half, okay? So that it has a neutral component and a charge component, okay? That's it. That's the whole theory. Because I'm dumb, I don't even know about Majorana particles and stuff like that. So I'll make it vector-like, and that's it. I have a vector-like doublet of charge of half. Well, for this guy, it turns out we know everything about the computation that goes in the computation that I sketched here, because the only processes involved are just standard model processes. For example, this guy can annihilate through a z into e plus e minus, okay? And so on, and other processes. So I know everything about it. So I can give a very tight range to its max. And it turns out that's between 1.2 TeV and 900 GeV. This is the range allowed by omega dark matter. So here's a very dumb dark matter candidate. It's really computable. To, you know, it's not the, there's no extra particles going around, nothing. And well, it can be beautiful dark matter, but its mass could be 1 TeV. Okay? If you make the quantum numbers of this guy a little bigger, so the second dumbest model would make the triplet, okay? And an electroweak triplet, and it would make it Majorana. This is the second dumbest. Okay, that has a neutral component. And this guy's mass is between, Jim will remember, it's like 3.2 TeV, a little higher, 3.5 TeV maybe, and 3.1 TeV. So these are two nice weakly interacting particles that if they're dark matter, they could be there and they could be a little heavy. Of course, it could also be a lot lighter. I mean, so there are also examples where there's hundreds of GeV. Okay? So there's a range, but it's a pretty decent sized range. I would say, in the end, maybe a two order of magnitude range somewhere around the weak scale. There are dark matter particles as light as 20 GeV and as heavy as 2 or 3 TeV. Okay? So they could be there, they could be sitting around the TeV scale. The LHC has enough energy to make this particle as enough energy to make that particle, sort of just, okay? But it won't make them. It won't make them in hardly any abundance because they're weakly interacting. The LHC is very good at making strongly interacting particles. Just as a figure of merit, you know, you can make strongly interacting triplets up to 3 or 4 TeV. You'll make weakly interacting particles up to 300, 400 GeV. Okay? So this is a very nice argument. There's no philosophy in this argument. You know, there's an actual computation, but they've got a pretty broad range, and it's not completely guaranteed that it's not totally guaranteed that the new physics at the TeV scale implied by this argument is necessarily that easy to see. That's why this is a much more serious argument. Okay? This is an argument that tells us that we have to see physics at the TeV scale. And as we'll, so we'll start off discussing the argument next time. We'll see that, in fact, it should be at the hundreds of GeV scale. Okay? So it's really an argument that tells you should be seeing something now, or as soon as the LHC turns on. A little bit of the tension, as we'll see, is that we might have expected to have seen it already. And that'll be some of the source of the attention that we'll talk about in the last two lectures. Anyway, I'll start off briefly reviewing this. Now, just so I have some calibration, how many people know about the hierarchy problem? Is this everybody? How many people do not know about the hierarchy problem? So do I need to draw the diagrams and stuff like that? Like I said, I'll do it very, very briefly. So I'll set it up and I'll talk about supersymmetry. And I think I can still do all the formulas that I need in an hour and a half. If I do a little quickly. So, okay. All right, thanks a lot.